Welcome back to Stateside. I'm April Baer. This weekend, you may notice a surprising number of people toting violin cases around Detroit. It's time for the Sphinx competition. Musician, composer, and educator Aaron Dworkin founded Sphinx in 1997. It is a competition and concert for young African-American and Latino string musicians. But its larger community, the Sphinx organization, is also a powerful engine for helping young people of color get connected in music circles and learn how to sustain careers. In a field so grounded in white Western European history, Sphinx alums have called it an invaluable tool for thinking through their relationships to music and to find other people doing that same reckoning. Aaron Dworkin's wife, Afa, now runs Sphinx. His own work at the University of Michigan has turned toward entrepreneurship in the arts, and he joins us now. Aaron Dworkin, good to have you on Stateside.
It's great to be here.
I know you've told this story about 1,000 times, but tell us a little bit about your path to discovering classical music.
Yeah, well, you know, for me, it started very early on. I was adopted when I was 2 weeks old, and my adoptive mother was an amateur violinist. So at the age of 5, I really took a liking to the instrument and luckily had great access to phenomenal teaching early on. And that led to really kind of, you know, ultimately this life in music. Had my debut with the Brooke Violin Concerto and the Hershey Symphony at the age of 13, and went through a variety of arts institutions that really helped to evolve and transform my life. And along the way, I became aware of kind of these issues surrounding diversity in classical music and initially as it related to my violin. And that kind of opened my mind up to the idea of, you know, kind of exploring social justice as it relates to diversity in the arts.
The period when you were in your teens and starting to think about a career in music, was that the period before most American symphonies took on the policy of blind auditions?
Well, no, actually, they were really pretty well engaged in blind auditions. And for me, actually, as a teen, I kind of wasn't even contemplating that. And it was actually not until I was here at the University of Michigan and went into a lesson one day with my teacher who inquired if I wanted to learn music by black composers, at which point I was like, what are you talking about? There are no black composers. Because no one had ever told me there were. It didn't even dawn on me there could be. And so that kind of opened my world up to things that I just didn't know existed in classical music. And it was then, as I began to think about that issue, that then I said, oh, so there are screens with orchestras. Oh, and there used to be this dramatic gender issue in orchestras. And that was not completely, but certainly significantly addressed through these issues of screens.
If a person doesn't play professionally with an orchestra, a person may not know that the way job interviews work for professional musicians auditioning for orchestras is that they are not seen. Once their resume has been submitted, orchestras fly in dozens, sometimes hundreds of people, and they are heard completely anonymously. The panel who's reviewing the quality of musicianship never sees the person. So it seems like even though the job audition, as it were, is a blind process, the inequities that we see in the system tend to crop up a lot earlier as kids are moving through their early lessons and conservatory training.
Yeah, and it's tough because it's this very odd thing, especially in the artistic sphere. You would think, wouldn't we want to know more about those who are auditioning than just kind of literally this blind hearing. There are so many other artistic adjudicative processes that would in some ways not be so limiting. However, it has addressed what was, this inherent deep gender bias amongst those who were selecting members of orchestras, and not only a screen, but also a carpet, so you couldn't hear the type of shoes, which could reveal gender. And so it's really, I think, been tremendous, the movement and the gains that have been made related to gender. But at the time, now over 20 years ago, we began to look at, well, how can we also hopefully affect the cultural diversity in the field?
The intent of Sphinx's founding back in 1997 was to give young players a place both to play together and to perhaps deepen their understanding of the tradition of composers of color. What was most difficult in the early years?
I think in many ways it was literally getting it started and getting people to believe that we could make a difference. No one I talked to doubted or disagreed with the fact that there was no cultural diversity in classical music. But pretty much the vast majority of people said, you really can't do anything about it. Many people said, well, that would be nice, but there really are not musicians of color who play at a professional level. Also pretty astounding, but that was a thing I heard from many people, including from people of color. And
saying there aren't enough of us to get together.
Correct,
and do
right.
Something.
It wasn't necessarily only emanating from prejudice or bias, but literally just from ignorance of the fact that in fact there was a huge swath of incredible musicians who happened to have, you know, these aspects of cultural diversity to them, and also as one of about seven or eight string musicians of color at the University of Michigan School of Music at the time. I knew I was not the only one. So I knew this. There were absolutely musicians out there. And then the final thing that, of course, very pragmatic, anytime you're building an organization, which now, of course, I teach students at Michigan how to do, was funding. And everyone said, well, even if you have the musicians and even if you have a great plan and even if we know this is so needed, you'll never get the funding to actually be able to do it. So you might as well do something else. Including my parents, who said I should just stop this and go back to practicing.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So
have they since come around on the idea?
Oh, this is a thing. They did, and actually, it was one of the most kind of powerful things that they said to me. And this was at the second competition, so basically the second year of Sphinx. And they said, you know, you're bringing about more impact with this than you ever could have, even if you would have become the world's greatest soloist.
What do you think has changed since 1997 when you founded Sphinx?
Well, probably one of the most important things is that I never hear anyone say anymore that musicians of color who play at the highest level are not out there. And that's the testament to all of the Sphinx alums who are doing just tremendous work and are in major orchestras, are in major teaching positions, have major solo careers, are in chamber music, and have populated the classical music field in a way that no longer permits anyone, unless they want to make a statement that flies in the face of facts, to say that musicians of color not only don't measure up, but are leading the field in many ways.
When you think about next frontiers, music directors, conductors are overwhelmingly white and still overwhelmingly male. What do you see as possible building blocks to help musicians who want to take that path for their own now, musicians of color?
Yeah, well, absolutely, and I think Sphinx is really hoping to strive for that. One of the ways is through bringing in guest conductors, which Sphinx does, like this year, Roderick Cox, you know, who's simply a tremendous leader in the field and has led many incredible orchestras and spent time as well in Minnesota. And so not only helping to provide support for those like Broderick Cox and others who are out in the field, but also providing visibility for their work, for their talent, so that others are aware of it. So one of the key things that Sphinx does every year is Sphinx Connect, so a gathering of over 800 of the professionals, leaders, practitioners, educators in the field who are interested in and or working with diversity in the field. And so one of the additional things that I used to hear a lot in the field from major institutions, orchestras, music schools, others is, well, we'd love to be more diverse, but no one shows up for our auditions, or no one, we don't know of a guest conductor to bring in, or we don't know repertoire to play.
This is parallel to the larger workplace conversation in America of hiring
yes.
managers tending to hire people like them, or somehow feeling that there aren't others in the field who might deserve consideration.
Exactly. And in this case, it doesn't necessarily need to emanate from a place of, you know, prejudice or bias, but rather just a sense of inability and lack of information and knowledge, and that it's just easier. It's easier for many organizations to simply not be diverse. And so one of the things that Sphinx Connect does is it demonstrates that, in fact, there is a huge marketplace of musicians of color who are at a level of excellence in all aspects of our field. And so that has really brought a level of responsibility and made it very difficult for any institutions to say, well, someone doesn't just show up, or we can't find anyone, because someone can just go, well, did you go to Sphinx Connect?
Here's a list, right.
And here's a list, yeah. So there's many, many initiatives that are being led by the organization under the leadership of AFA that really are making that ongoing evolution occur on a constant basis.
If you're just joining us, my guest is composer and educator Aaron Dworkin. He's the founder of the Sphinx Organization, which aims to increase opportunities in classical music for young African-American and Latino string players. This year, as Sphinx returns to Detroit, you will be joining with a new spoken word multimedia composition. It's called The American Rhapsody. And this is music by Samuel Coleridge Taylor, who just, I can't believe that someone of his talent is constantly conflated with the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge, but he's a standout figure in classical music and one of the earlier composers of color that we know of. The piece is called Symphonic Variations on an African Air for Full Orchestra, with additional elements that you added. How did the idea for this piece come to you?
Yeah, well, so actually, since my time here at Michigan as a student, this is where I first began to explore combining spoken word with classical music, almost kind of, if you will, classic rap, and began exploring that. And that led to, you know, developing a host of both chamber as well as orchestral pieces that I've done over the past couple of decades. There's, you know, kind of this well-known piece of Lincoln Portrait by Aaron Copland and that I had performed. And so I was looking at this and I felt like there was an opportunity for a new work that could take the reflections of one of the original, you know, forefathers of our nation, but engage that with music by a composer of color and speak to the issues that are relevant to us today. And so in that process, it led me to the writings and speeches of George Washington, and to try and reflect from that both his commentary on democracy, which I believe is very relevant today for many people, but to also show the complexity of human leadership, and that while there is so much we can learn and reflect on about democracy today and his example, he also owned 317 slaves. And to show that complexity, because that is part of the human condition. And so I thought it would be very interesting to kind of juxtapose in a singular work the writings and thought of the, you know, great American leader of the rebellion against Britain, while at the same time utilizing the music of a Black British composer, Samuel Coleridge Taylor. So, and of course, this is a gorgeous, amazing work that Taylor wrote, inspired by a Negro spiritual troubled in mind that he heard the Fisk Jubilee singers sing when they came over to Great Britain. And so
he's a British composer reacting to American folk tradition.
Exactly.
In bringing this to life.
Exactly. And I take that and combine it with the words of George Washington. So it's a very interesting, evocative work, and one that I feel, and certainly from the premiere in Minnesota, seemed to spark a lot of thought and reflection and emotion in the audience.
Let's listen to a bit. This is from a performance the Minnesota Orchestra did in 2019.
Washington's words were, "We are either a united people or we are not. If the former, let us in all matters of general concern act as a nation. If we are not, let us no longer act a farce by pretending to it."
Aaron Dworkin, how would you describe the role that spoken word plays against the background of music in this setting?
Yeah, so for me, one of the things that's really important is some of the things that have occurred with spoken word or classical music in the past, it's really almost narration, where there's either the music and or there's the narration. If the two are at the same time, music is kind of in the background.
It's sort of the case in the Aaron Copland Lincoln portrait.
Exactly. And there's a huge orchestral opening in that piece. And so they're, in some ways, from my perspective, very separated. But what I love, and hopefully the audience hears in American Rhapsody, is a full integration between the text and the voice as well as the music. And while there are times we have a few points where there is a monologue or the orchestra has a grand pause to highlight a particular segment of text, both the articulation of voice, the rise and fall of phrases, I articulate and I design and I architect between the text and the music. So it's a very integrated piece. So from that kind of artistic approach, I love the medium of spoken word and classical music.
What do you hear from young musicians who are looking for places for their own creations to be heard?
Well, it's interesting because while I do hear a lot of frustration sometimes on the part of young musicians, I would say that arguably we are living in a time when there are more opportunities to be heard as an artist than ever before. You know, before there were just very few avenues and they were controlled by gatekeepers and that was it. But today, anyone can, you know, record what they're doing, including even on a phone, let alone in a room at a relatively high level, and be able to put that recording online through a variety of platforms and have it be heard. And so your ability to connect with audiences, I think, is more powerful than ever. What that also means is audiences have become incredibly fractured. And so to try and get to slice through, to get out there into the world so that people are aware of your art can often be very frustrating to young musicians. And I think ultimately, one of the things I talk about with my students is how do you balance that time? How much time do I devote to actually the creation, development of my talent and of my art? And how much do I, you know, commit to, if you will, this business side of my art? And that is not an easy question to answer.
Aaron Dworkin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful to be here.
We've been talking today with Aaron Dworkin, founder of the Sphinx Organization. Its annual competition and concert finals are happening this weekend at the Fisher Music Center in Detroit. Sphinx is dedicated to helping Black and Latino classical musicians and to bringing them together. I spoke with a couple of people whose lives have been shaped in different ways by their time with Sphinx. Cameron Williams is studying cello at the University of Michigan. He's a Sphinx alum and now does administrative work for the organization. Violinist Danielle Belen was the winner of the 2008 Sphinx competition. She's now an assistant professor of violin at the University of Michigan and a Sphinx board member. I asked Danielle Belen about the 2008 performance with Sphinx that changed everything for her. And just a note, she had her infant daughter with her the day of the interview, so you might hear a little cooing and fussing now and then.
2008 was a game changer of a year for me. I hadn't participated actually as part of the Sphinx organization at all. I didn't even know the depth and breadth of what I was getting into. And I was fortunate to play very well that year, and the judges recognized me as the first place laureate. And I remember my mom was in the audience, and I could almost see like little tears welling up in her eyes. Because I wasn't a big competition person. That wasn't something that I had done a lot of. So it meant so much. And little did I know that just, 5 years later, I would be teaching at the University of Michigan and becoming even more involved with the organization. Now I'm a board member. I've judged the competition. I have students participating in the competition.
Can I just take you back to the year, to 2008?
Sure.
Will you tell us about your signature performance that year? What piece did you play?
Let's see. Well, one of the videos that's actually still up on YouTube is a piece by William Grant Still, an African-American composer, called Mother and Child, and it's the second movement of his beautiful suite. ¶¶ It's actually, I think, influenced by this beautiful sculpture that I believe is made of ebony, and it's this sort of like very curvy sculpture of a mother holding her child. Right now I'm rocking my child next to me too in the studio.
It's so meta. I love it.
I know, totally. And then with my mom in the audience, you know, it was like this whole thing with this mother and child. It's just such a beautiful piece. I actually technically learned a lot from playing that piece, even though it doesn't sound like a super virtuosic piece. Typically, competitions don't choose works like that.
They tend to favor works that have like some terribly hard technical thing about
yeah.
them.
Well, I had to play that too. I had to play the Wieniawski Polonaise in D major, like right after that. And, you know, it's not just you're doing this competition and competing. You're doing it on the stage of Detroit Symphony Hall in front of a live audience being filmed. I mean, it's a tremendous amount of pressure. However, they create this kind of familial environment where you actually feel like people are genuinely cheering for you to do well in this experience.
People saw this video of you on stage with everybody in Sphinx, and all of a sudden the calls start coming, and you became a soloist in Pittsburgh and Atlanta and Nashville, the Boston Pops, the Cleveland Orchestra. I mean, would any of that have happened without this competition?
No, definitely not. I was not on that track with my career. Yet somehow, because of having done this competition, rather than being totally terrified of soloing with all those orchestras, I kind of knew I could do it. If I had done that terrifying thing, I can do the next terrifying thing. And my teacher, Robert Lipset, who's been my longtime mentor and now colleague and friend, he somehow knew I could do it too. And he told me, you know what, if you want to be the best teacher you can be, having this host of high-level experiences behind you will make you so much stronger. And he was absolutely right. I spent about a year and a half sort of touring around as a soloist with all these orchestras because of Sphinx. And it was life-changing in how I viewed myself.
The end game for all the artists who are in Sphinx competition, and maybe just all artists, is to find your community and figure out how you're going to use that to find your place in the musical world or in whatever world you end up making a living in. I mean, Cameron, what kind of questions are in your mind as you look out at the ecosystem right now that a lot of these young artists are going to be walking into?
For me, I think what I'm looking at is like, not only how can I be good at my instrument, what other skills can I bring that also enhance this idea of being a musician, putting myself out there, and being able to do other roles that go beyond playing an instrument.
So, such as?
Being able to do things administratively, like as I'm currently doing with Sphinx, being able to curate, write, having other outlets that maybe are focused towards music and that are related, but kind of in a way of just not putting all your eggs in one basket.
You know, it's kind of like Danielle was saying, there is that world of soloists that everybody knows about, mm-hmm. which is incredibly cutthroat and really kind of a hard life. But I think oftentimes musicians come up not being aware that there's a life in music beyond that particular place on the stage.
Yeah, and that definitely took some time for me to realize. And I think it wasn't until I came to Michigan and I started getting involved with Sphinx when I realized, I was like, okay, like, I need some skills that go beyond the concert hall.
What are you doing outside of your studies at the U of M? Mm-hmm. What is your community like right now?
I would say my community, I'm trying to branch out as much as I can, especially in these past 2 to 3 years, as I know my time is dwindling. I play in most of the regional orchestras within the area. I'm involved with an ensemble that I co-run with a friend called En Route. I also do a radio show as well called Voices Unheard at WCBN Ann Arbor, which I use as a platform to have friends or anyone from the community come on and share any projects or concerts or any material that they want to have heard over the radio or share with other people. And then also, when I am playing music, I only play music by underrepresented composers or lesser-known works. And then teaching as well with youth orchestra out in Detroit and maintaining my own private studio. Yeah, and traveling. So it's kind of wearing these multiple hats and staying busy and seeing what goes where and following that opportunity.
I would ask both of you, If anyone who's participating in the competition this year was listening, what would you tell them about making the most of this time?
Hold nothing back. Just let yourself just be you and just play. Don't worry about anything. Just play. Let the music talk and follow your emotions and your gut. And definitely just leave it all on the stage.
Danielle, how about you? You've seen this from so many different levels.
I think that's great advice. I think if you are worried about missing a note, you're going to miss the note. Mm-hmm. you're going to be on stage for just 10 minutes or so. It's going to be over so soon. And then you're going to be like, oh, I wish I'd been more in the moment. I wish I'd been taking chances and going for it. This is the nurturing environment. So take advantage of it and then go on stage and just cut loose.
Danielle Bailén is a violinist, a teacher, an associate professor of violin at the School of Music, Theater, and Dance at the University of Michigan. Cameron Williams, cello, is studying at the U of M right now. Thank you both for being here. We really appreciate hearing from you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you so much.
If you're ready for the full Sphinx experience, this is the weekend. A public concert is scheduled Friday night for three junior division finalists accompanied by the Sphinx Honors Orchestra. And the competition finals are Saturday night. All of this is happening at the Fisher Music Center in Detroit. Arts and culture coverage on Stateside is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.